more could make it any worse.
Now he knew he was in trouble. I recognized the tune. Over 20-some years, the folks sitting in that leather club chair in front of my desk have found only a few old standards in the jukebox. I didn't do it. The other one did it. Why are they picking on me? His selection, I'm Sorry, made the easiest listening. But they all wanted to hear the same song from me. Maybe I can get you out of this. I said it, usually, although I knew it would often prove untrue. But it's a complicated business being somebody's only hope. This is a lawyer's story, the kind attorneys like to hear and tell, about a case, about a client. His name was Robert Favor. Everyone knew him as Robbie, although he was getting old for that kind of thing. 43, he'd said when I asked his age. The time was 1992, the second week in September. The pundits had finally stopped predicting that Ross Perot was going to be the next president of the United States, and the terms dot and com had not yet been introduced to one another. I recall the period precisely because the week before I had returned to Virginia to lay my father to rest. His passing, which over the years I'd assumed I would take as being in the natural order of things, had instead imbued all my waking moments with the remote quality of dreams, so that even my hand, when I considered it, seemed disconnected from my body. Robbie Favor's troubles were more immediate. Last night, three special agents of the Internal Revenue Service's Criminal Intelligence Division had visited him at home, one to talk and two to listen. They were, as you would expect, rumpled men in inexpensive sport coats, grave but polite. They had handed him a grand jury subpoena for all of his law partnership's financial records and tried to ask Robbie questions about his income tax returns. Wisely, he had refused to reply. He could suit himself, responded the one agent who spoke. But they wanted to tell him a couple things, good news and bad. Bad first. They knew. They knew what Robbie and his law partner, Morton Dinnerstein, had been up to. They knew that for several years the two had occasionally deposited a check they received when they won or settled one of their personal injury cases in a secret account at River National Bank, where the firm transacted no other business. They knew that out of the River National account, Dinnerstein and Robbie had paid the usual shares of what they'd earned, 2/3 to the clients, 1/9 to the referring attorneys, odd amounts to experts or court reporters. Everyone had received his due, except the IRS. They knew that for years now, Favor and his partner had been writing checks to cash to draw down the balance of the account, never paying a dime in tax. You guys are cold-cocked, the agent added. Robbie laughed now, very briefly, repeating the words. I didn't ask how Robbie and his partner could have ever believed a scheme so simple-minded would work. I was long accustomed to the dumb ways people get themselves in trouble. Besides, the fact was that their scam had operated smoothly for years. A checking account that paid no interest was unlikely to come to the service's attention. It was, frankly, noteworthy that it had, a development that would inevitably be traced to freak coincidence, or, if things were spicier, betrayal. Favor had heard out the agents in his living room. He was perched on a camelback sofa, smartly upholstered in bleached silk, trying to contain himself, to smile, stay slick. He opened his mouth to speak, but was interrupted by the unexpected sensation of a single cold rill of his own sweat tracking the length of his side until it was absorbed in the elastic waistband of his boxers. "And the good news?" he asked on second effort. "They were getting to that," the agent said. The good news was that Robbie had an opportunity. Maybe there was something he could do for himself, something that a person with his family's situation ought to consider.